Indie Media is DIY News. It is about people reporting their own news directly, without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media. There are now almost 100 Indie Media websites or IMCs worldwide, providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns, and protests. The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests that shut down the World Trade Organization summit. Uncensored and unsponsored, indie media sites can be updated literally anytime, anywhere, and by anyone. The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from those global websites and the UK's very own indie media site. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Hi and welcome to the show. It's Wednesday the 26th of May and coming up we've got, as has just been said, the usual highlights of the indie media news wires from around the world. We're starting with a piece about community radio, and this is in no way related to ITN's news announcement yesterday that Resonance has only 12 days left to broadcast. Whack whack, not true. So here we go with the first story.
The community radio movement has grown worldwide over the last 30 years, establishing a new tier of broadcasting that is challenging the traditional public and commercial sectors. But just as community radio in the UK is starting to finally get a foothold, intense lobbying from the commercial sector to restrict community radio could limit its growth and even possibly kill it at birth. Community radio is characterised by public access to and public participation in radio production. The management of a community radio station is in the hands of its listeners and users. Community radio's emphasis on participation allows listeners to become involved in their station to a degree not possible with local public or commercial stations. Community radio breaks down the traditional divide between the broadcaster and listener, and with community radio, the listener can become the broadcaster and get engaged in the production of media and in the process of communication. Community radio can also bridge the communications divide in other ways. Radio is a cheap, established, and effective communications medium and is able to reach the poorest community in the most in the most remote of localities. Poor communities in the north as well as the south, from marginalised populations on the fringes of urban environments to small rural communities in remote locations. In Europe, community radio has largely grown out of the pirate radio movement, and many other pirate radio stations are now completely legal. In Germany, Radio Z is one of the oldest free radio stations, being founded in 1984 and started broadcasting in 1987. And now the community radio stations are sharing their programmes via an internet archive, making the content available for non-commercial use. While media law in Germany principally supports community radio with the demand for diversity of opinions and programmes that have to contribute to literacy, education, culture and entertainment, and that significant political, social and philosophical groups are given a say too, the main difficulties for most community radios lies in insufficient funding. Some, like Radio Patapul in Amsterdam and Contraband FM in Barcelona, remain unlicensed in continued opposition to legal restrictions. In this country, Radio 4 recently celebrated 5 years of broadcasting no budget community radio in Brighton, despite several attempts by the Department of Trade and Industry to take them off air over the years.
In North America, community radio has developed as a licensed service through a few community stations are deemed illegal due to the restrictive regulatory framework and a lack of available frequencies. These include Free Radio Berkeley, and San Francisco Liberation Radio. The micro radio and low power FM projects have also played a part in developing community radio in the US. In Latin America, the community media sector has grown in the last 50 years to become thousands of radio stations. In the 1980s, there were only a handful of independent radio stations in Africa. Now hundreds of community broadcasters in South Asia are on air. Asia is now starting to open up. Nepal has been a shining example in South Asia, where there are now 7 community radio stations on air and 15 more that are about to start. Communities in Southeast Asia, the Philippines in particular, have had a strong tradition of community broadcasting that continues to grow. Community media is all over the world and in every continent, but not yet in every country. In the UK, community radio is under attack, just as it has been getting established. The UK government's Access Radio pilot scheme has seen 15 community radio stations broadcasting, including Resonance FM, successfully for over 2 years now. Recently, the creation of a £500,000 community media fund has been announced to help finance the community sector. However, the Commercial Radio Companies Association, the CRCA, a powerful industry-sponsored lobbying agency, is seeking to stifle the growth of community radio by arguing for a regulatory framework that would bar certain areas from the UK from having the right to set up a community radio station. In other areas, community radio stations would not be able to carry advertising and sponsorship at all, thus depriving them of much-needed income, and proposals would also allow commercial stations to object to new community radios operating in their areas. For more background, links and information on how you can oppose these moves, check out the feature on indiemedia.org.uk. You can also check out the radio section on the UK Indie Media site and the global Indie Media radio site at radio.indiemedia.org. Well, I love the way you
Okay, that was the Stabilizers with their hit Bendy Head. You may think that David Blunkett's hundreds of new laws, harsh use of the Terrorism Act, hard line on immigration, and proposed Civil Contingencies Act are going to limit your freedom. But if none of these touch your life, the new biometric ID card will. The cards will allegedly protect us from illegal immigrants and terrorists, but how could they protect us from Al-Qaeda members travelling on legitimate foreign passports is unclear. Biometric cards wouldn't have prevented 9/11 or the Madrid bombing either. Dave's a bit doubtful too, telling Parliament, "I accept that it's important that we do not pretend that an entitlement card will be an overwhelming factor in combating international terrorism. So why do we need them then? What it is sure is that the cards will cost you a lot of money, £3.1 billion or about £51 for every man, woman and child, according to the Home Office. Last March, a leaked government report said that more than £1.5 billion in taxpayers' money has been wasted on other botched IT schemes over the last 6 years. Hopefully the cost of all the equipment needed to read the high-tech cards, recognise iris scans and fingerprints has been taken into account by the corporations brought in to manage the scheme. Going by the Home Office's record on large public projects, though, the figure will rise significantly as interested companies always brag they can sort the contract out for a lot less than it ends up costing. Organisations such as Privacy International, Stand, Liberty, Statewatch and FIPR last week held a public meeting under the title Mistaken Identity. The meeting gave a resounding vote of no confidence over the national identity card, leading politicians, lawyers, regulators, security experts and civil libertarians unanimous in condemning the proposals. The president of the Law Society, representing 116,000 solicitors throughout the UK, also warned in his statement that the government's draft legislation contained dangerous provisions. Following on from this, we now bring you some research from snews.org.uk.
The implementation and running of the system is likely to be taken up by Schlumberger Sima, a company which is already conducting trials with the passport agency to produce biometric ID cards. Schlumberger, who have been bought by Atos Origin, say that their best-of-breed solutions can help your company achieve a smart and robust level of security. Well, that's reassuring. However, Schlumberger have a history of ever so slightly less than popular schemes, extracting taxpayers' money often to make a quick buck. Under the government's Benefit Integrity Project, people receiving benefits because of illness or disability were asked to prove that they couldn't work. Now, usually it takes around an hour for a doctor to properly check this, to check that somebody is ill, as they say they are, or that they are disabled. But Sima, who were brought in to do these checks and were often paid per visit, managed to rattle off checkups within a matter of minutes. As a result of this, thousands of people did lose their benefits. However, the government eventually scrapped this programme due to, quote, a serious error of judgment. Now, the company does have some experience in the spying game, however. Sima's got the benefit of John Deutsch, disgraced former director of the CIA, on its board. Now, he's got a bit of a murky track record in the Pentagon as well, with the company helping to oversee the US invasions of El Salvador, Nicaragua and Grenada. His experience with data security is not too hot either. He was dismissed from the CIA for keeping 17,000 pages of, according to the CIA, enormously sensitive material at the highest levels of classification on his home computer, which he was also allowing his children to use to do their homework and to surf the net. Well, a track record like that on the protection of sensitive data might be problematic, especially as Blunkett has justified the scheme on the basis that our liberties will be strengthened if our identity is protected from theft. Privacy International's director Simon Davies has warned that the technology gap between governments and organised crime has now narrowed to such an extent that even the most highly secured cards are available as blanks weeks after their introduction. Criminals and terrorists can in reality move more freely and more safely with several fake official secure identities than they ever could in a country using multiple forms of low-value ID such as birth certificates. But it might not just be the criminals who are after our data. The scheme will rely on computers being used, with all our private information being accessed by thousands of people, especially the boys in blue. Now, the Police Complaints Commission has admitted that there will always be a few officers willing to risk their careers by obtaining data improperly. Now, that's just the police. Another important question: how does the Home Office hope to establish an applicant's true identity before issuing a new secure ID card? Well, they say with an existing form of ID. But if these aren't secure in the first place, what's to stop a rapidly growing number of our enemies using these to get new fake secure IDs? 10 years ago, no political party would have dared to say they were going to introduce ID cards so forcefully. Now that Tony and his chums have found us a whole range of new and dangerous foes, the ID cards are firmly on the agenda. The Home Office promises that only a limited amount of information will be stored on the cards, but 10 years on, ministers will undoubtedly call for an increase in the amount of information held, and the potential preemptive use of that information. Just as terror suspects now can be detained for posing a potential threat to security, so you may be detained in the future based on information gathered on your ID card. For more information on the fight against ID cards, see www.privacyinternational.org and www.defy-id.org.uk. There's meetings going on up and down the country over this issue, and there's one happening in Brighton at the Cowley Club on June the 21st at 5:30.
Why? I'm going to leave that Tony, you know, because it's too hot.
Was The Specials with Too Hot. Last Friday, a new occupied social centre opened to the public in East London. A great deal of work has already been done to make the space usable. There are three houses occupied and about a dozen residents. This is a moderate-sized hall that has been decorated and a bar and stage assembled for events. Meanwhile, a ground floor kitchen and dining room is being converted into a cafe space, a cinema, and computers with Wi-Fi access are being installed. Additionally, there is a three-store warehouse occupied within the same block, which has massive potential for dance classes, conferences, gatherings, crush space, workshops, campaign offices, exhibitions, talks, banner paintings, and so on. There is currently no way the space can be open to the public on a daily basis, so it will be operating solely as a meetings and event area until such time as there's sufficient people and energy to take things further. As is usual with such projects, the Rampart says they urgently need people to volunteer some time, either on occasional or a regular basis. People are also needed to organise events, run workshops, schedule the meetings, etc. The address for the hall is 7A Rampart Street, which is off Commercial Road and Cannon Street. Nearest tube is Shadwell.
Yet another social centre opened in Oxford as a new Scot was opened for the second Osset Social Centre, the previous one having been evicted a couple of weeks earlier after a short but productive existence. In Scotland, a temporary social centre sprung up in Glasgow at the beginning of May, with a pre-packed daily schedule of events and workshops running till the end of June. On the 17th of this month, the latest Womble Social Centre, the ex-Grand Banks in Tufnell Park, successfully resisted the first attempt to repossess the building, and the social centre remains open with a running programme. There are many other autonomous social centres that have been established much longer, such as the Sumac Centre in Nottingham, 56A and Use Your Loaf in South London, the One to One in Bradford, Lark and Freedom in East London, the Autonomous Centre of Edinburgh, Keeble in Bristol, the Cowley Club in Brighton and the People's Information Centre in Hebden Bridge, all of which need ongoing community support. And on a final note, the Use Your Loaf Centre, and that's situated in South London, has got a work day this Sunday, that's the 23rd, running from midday to do up and repair the building. And they're providing free food for the workers, and the location is 227 Deptford High Street in London. And for more details on that, you can see the feature on indiemedia.org.uk.
Fuzz Lane Peace Camp celebrates 22 years resisting UK's nukes. They planned a week of activities from the 7th to 13th of June, workshops on direct action, stencil graffiti and more. The week includes a party on the Saturday with sound system and bands. For information, see www.fazlanepeacecamp.co.uk.
Last year, Adidas sponsored a series of sports training days in Edinburgh, but local kids were having none of it. After Adidas Man came to visit, posing for photos with children kitted out in Adidas gear, the kids got together with anti-sweatshop group No Sweat, the Parents Teacher Council, TUC, Green Party and others, pushing to ban brands from schools. They're producing leaflets about sweatshops and human rights abuses in the Far East factories by the big brands, and now the campaign is spreading to other parts of Scotland. A petition has been launched, and No Sweat say Edinburgh Council are reviewing the guidelines on sponsorship in schools. For more info, see www.nosweat.org.uk.
Following the string of recent announcements of GM companies walking away from commercialisation processes of GM crops, and indeed wholesale withdrawal from the sector, now some bad news. The ban on genetically modified food in the EU, which has been in place for nearly 6 years, was last week removed when the European Commission approved a type of genetically modified sweet corn. This will allow fresh and tinned genetically modified sweet corn to be imported into EU states for human consumption. Farmers are already allowed to use the GM sweet corn in animal feed. The Commission voted in favour of the sweet corn, which is marketed as BT11, by the Swiss company Syngenta, after the governments of member states failed to reach an agreement. Under new EU laws, the sweet corn must, however, be labelled as genetically modified before it can be sold in shops. Friends of the Earth has serious doubts about the safety studies carried out on Syngenta's BT11. A report by the Australian government also gives a damning verdict of the safety tests carried out by Syngenta, concluding that the safety of BT11 is based on theoretical argument rather than evidence. The Commission is totally ignoring public opinion, it should be said. In a survey last winter, 86% of the British public said they were against GM food. Sue Mayer of Greenwatch UK, said, "It shows how the Commission and Europe are being bullied by the US and the WTO. The European Commission has ignored the people it represents and given in to pressure from big business, the WTO, the US, Canada and Argentina. However, the hostile public reception of GM foods means the ruling will not translate into GM sweet corn being sold in lots of British shops, or at least we don't think so." David Southall of the British Retail Consortium said, "I don't know anyone who will even give it a trial because of the consumer attitude."
In the morning on Thursday the 20th of May 2004, around 20 anti-arms trade activists arrived at the premises of EDO MBM Technology in Brighton. EDO MBM manufacture bomb and missile release components for military aircraft. They are on record as being proud to support the ongoing occupation of Iraq. A cage of fences was set up with people locking themselves to it, blocking the access road, and banners were hung, one offering a potential corporate slogan, "Every death an opportunity." Shortly afterwards, more activists appeared on the roof of the factory, while others handed out leaflets explaining what must have seemed an interesting intervention in the workers' daily shift. All but the suited senior management types turned around and had the day off. Police eventually removed the blockade and arrested six people who were locked onto it. They were unable to get the people down from the roof of the building, One came down voluntarily after several hours because he had broken his ankle. Three more came down later after enjoying the sunshine and unrivalled views of Brighton from around 7 a.m. until the late afternoon. All these four were arrested. One person remained on the roof until late evening and was also finally arrested. And we have Jesse here, who's a legal observer at that event.
Hello.
So hiya. Yeah. So what was that like?
Oh, it was a terrific event. It was beautiful to see. Great sunny morning and nobody was there. Then the fencing was dropped off. There were 8 sections of fencing, and within a matter of minutes the whole thing was set up into this remarkable enclosure with people attached by bike locks on the inside.
So it was pretty well organized. They turned up with lots of fencing.
Yeah, and lots of enthusiasm. And at the same time as that was happening, other activists, far from where I could see, were getting up onto the roof. So at the same time as the blockade was set up, the roof was set up too.
And so what was the police's reaction to the protesters?
Well, they arrived about 20 minutes into the blockade's existence when people phoned up and told them about it. And They were very confident and calm when they arrived, which was really nice to see, because you don't want police, like, flipping out first thing. And for about an hour or two, it was really quite an amicable situation until the higher-ups in the police force arrived and got kind of nervous. And actually, we had a lot of presence of very high-ranking police. We had a superintendent, we had a chief inspector, and we had the chief press officer for the region from the police.
What's the reaction of the workers to this kind of blockade?
Well, I think that they were turned away by phone, some of them, before they even got a chance to come near us. I know that some of them were met on the way from the train platform. I don't think very many were coming up the road to us close enough for me to actually see the reactions, but I know people who were further down the street met them and said that they were a bit angry about the situation, you know, it being their workplace. And
did you manage to speak to anyone from EDO-MBM?
Well, one gentleman did come down. The people locked on insisted that someone come down and speak to them, but no one did. And eventually a man came down looking very irate, but silent. And eventually people who were locked on said, are you from EDO? And he said, I'm not willing to comment on that. So then they knew he was, obviously, and they just started asking him provocative questions. And he answered with sort of adequate answers, but not particularly strong.
Did he seem disturbed at company's involvement in Iraq?
No, he seemed disturbed at the success of the questions at stumping him, and disturbed at the fact that we had so apparently effortlessly managed to make it so they didn't have any production that whole day.
And one protester broke his ankle. How did that happen?
Yeah, this protester, quite a dedicated protester, as I understand, actually broke his ankle on the way over the fence, and ended up still climbing up onto the roof and staying there for about 4 hours. It was really extraordinary.
So that's pretty hardcore.
Real commitment, yeah.
So and what would you say the outcome of this protest will be?
I think that it's an inspiration to other activists, given that it was a very small group in a very highly populated area. And also, I think it really consolidated attention onto EDO, which hadn't really garnered that kind of attention in Brighton. In fact, this weekend, I understand that someone splashed red paint on the building, probably made aware of the building by our protest.
So, well done.
Thank you.
You take away my time, my peace, my empathy. No. ugliest girl you've ever seen. Someday she will die, though. What was she for, Valentine? An old forgotten concubine. Someday she will die for no one. She seems to me to know all the glitters, the sour, all the lies in her place. Jesus saves. No day. Pretend you have no rivals. We all know that she's friendless. Spits at mirrors, it's not an issue. Just remove the hateful tissue. We all know her rage is endless. She seems to me someday she will just refuse. She seems to me to know all the glitters are sour, all the lies in her place. Jesus saves. No.
The Italian Senate approved something called the Urbani Act. This is a new regulation on intellectual property and piracy repression, aiming to punish free information flow and clearly made up to imitate American legislation. From now on, every creative work released through the internet or any other electronic network should be accompanied by what they're calling a virtual license or a virtual button of the Italian Association of Editors and Authors, certifying its compliance with the copyright laws and informing about the penalty for breaking the act. The rule applies to every intellectual work, quote, inserted on the net. So that could include web pages, shared files, emails, and so on. Infringing the act will be a crime. Downloading even a single MP3 with the purpose of, quote, taking advantage of it, now the Act purposely employs such a blurry and wide description, it's now punishable by the seizure of all of your hardware, all of your media, and a fine of up to €1,500 and up to 4 years in prison. In addition, the Urbani Act increases taxes on hardware support and devices such as CD, DVD, and CD-DVD burners. The only good news is that the internet service providers in Italy will not be forced to pass personal data of their users to the authorities, as was initially proposed within the legislation. But that's no comfort, really, as the proposed EU legislation on data retention and other proposed EU legislation will quite happily deal with that at a later date. The approval of the Act did not meet any strong opposition at all from the left-wing parties, and it was only a small number of associations who campaign on digital rights, including Linux users groups and some people from the Green Party. It was only these people that opposed the legislation. There was one demonstration held in front of the Italian Senate on the day of the approval of the Act. Now, this Act, like many other forms of legislation, is based on an unrealistic vision of the internet. It will be absolutely impossible to effectively enforce such an Act, since too much information would have to be monitored. Therefore, the Act will only result in the prosecution of a few unlucky people, or rather, those people the authorities wish to target. For more information on this outrageous Act, check out the Italy Indie Media Centre at italy.indiemedia.org.
Sussex University's World Bank Recruitment Day was cancelled recently at short notice due to planned demonstrations. The last time they came to town, their rep got a pie in their face, literally, and the session was shut down as the seminar was occupied by demonstrators. The university tried to keep this year's visit under wraps, but word got out and demonstrations were planned. Brian Haw, who has been protesting for three years last week in Parliament Square against sanctions and the war in Iraq, appeared in court, charged with assaulting a police officer and failing to leave a security cordoned area. He is bailed to appear again in court on the 1st of June and would appreciate support. This Thursday at 9 p.m, Indie Media Cinema is showing Development Flows from the Barrel of a Gun, produced by Indian activists on the state violence faced by the indigenous people when they protest against development projects. That's at the other cinema, 11 Rupert Street, London, £6.50 or £4.50 concessions. Tonight at 7 p.m, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. You can ask your questions to Ken Livingston, Simon Hughes, Steve Norris, Darren Johnson, Lindsay German. Come and hear what the mayoral candidates have to say about peace issues in London. For more information, see www.cnduk.org. And this Friday, the 28th of May, is London Critical Mass. Join hundreds of other cyclists in London as we reclaim the streets from traffic for an evening of bicycle celebration. After last month's 10th anniversary extravaganza, we expect this to be a really fun ride. Bring your bikes, your mates, music, energy and life. Meet up at 6 p.m. under Waterloo Bridge on the South Bank. This month it's been proposed we head for the north end of Blackfriars Bridge for 7:30 p.m. for a memorial gathering in remembrance of a cyclist who was killed there last week. Also, and on Saturday there's the Haringey Critical Mass Bike Ride 2004 for clean air and safe streets from 11 a.m. at the Manor House Tube, finishing at Chestnuts Park Festival at 12:30.
Cayó la luna, se apaga el farol.
Two activists charged with aggravated trespass while protesting inside and against the Iraq procurement conference in London on April the 27th have had their trial date set for July the 9th. The Iraq Procurement Conference was an event dedicated to the privatisation of Iraq industries and services, and operated with the final goal of British companies clinching contracts in the war-torn country. The definition of the charges that the two activists state, that they were disrupting a lawful meeting. The two unravelled banners and addressed the delegates as collaborators and complicit in the daily massacres in Iraq. They will be arguing that the meeting was actually an unlawful event itself, as it was facilitating acts of pillage illegal under the Hague Regulations of 1970. In a leaked memo dated March the 26th, the UK Attorney General Lord Peter advised Prime Minister Blair that in his view, quote, the imposition of major structural economic reforms would not be authorised under international law, and that's a very serious point there. As a result, the two will be calling the Attorney General to the stand to give evidence. In addition, they also need a couple of extra expert legal and economics witnesses to give evidence to support the already widely accepted belief that the privatisation of Iraq by foreign occupying powers and their corporate sponsors is and was illegal. If this case succeeds, it will set a legal precedent and in effect put the pillage of Iraq on trial and, hopefully, they say, aid the people of Iraq in reclaiming their resources from foreign corporate monopolies. And the trial, as we said, is going to start on July the 9th at Highbury Magistrates Court. We're almost out of time now. We're going to play out with an outro that's a mix up of various different bits of audio, some serious and some funny. So until next week, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization.
They keep on bombarding this area in front of us. Have they not finished with all these? Look, if they want to bombard the palaces, are they not our heritage? Because it is secret, because it's the birthplace of our president, they went and bombarded one of the best museums in the country. Do you know that? Do you know they have attacked our university, which is called Mustafa? Do you know they have attacked one of the oldest schools in the whole world, called Mustafa School? Do you know that? Well, please tell your people, let them have a respect for human heritage. This is not Iraq's heritage only. It belongs to the whole world.
To the Iraqi people, let me say that the day of your liberation will soon be at hand.
Do you think we believe that you come to free us? Why can't you be either human or logical? You are neither human nor logical in this act. And I was surprised and shocked to hear people applauding your president this evening for the nonsense he was saying. Everybody knows it.
However long it takes to win, however long it takes to achieve our objective, that's important for you to know, the American people to know, our allies to know, and the Iraqi people to know. However long it takes.
You should hear today the people who were bombarded in a very local, modest area where people go and have their fruits because we eat. Don't think we are hungry people. We have fresh fruit every day. We have fresh vegetables every day. People were going to shop. And there were two rockets on that area. Why? Why? What for?
We're working together to make the world more peaceful. We're working together to make our respective nations and all the free nations of the world more secure. And we're working to free the Iraqi people.
And you tell me you are here not for oil? What are you for then? Killing people? Just killing people like that?
I often try to put myself in other people's shoes and ask myself, in this case, for example, an Iraqi citizen, what they have to be seeing is a good deal of evidence that the Iraqi people want to be liberated.
Democracy doesn't come by rockets. Democracy comes by dialogue. Why do you want us to listen to your rockets? You talk about peace, you talk about having no interest in Iraq but to free Iraq. How could you free Iraq with your rockets and your bombardment?
And killing leads to killing leads to killing. Jesus wouldn't be in favor of nuclear war.
What I want to do is make people to realize that they're ultimately responsible for their own fate here.
I said there was a little boy in Hiroshima reaching up to catch a red dragonfly in his hand against the blue of the sky, and there was a blinding flash, and he literally disappeared and left his shadow behind him. I said, my God. I said, further out, if you look at the flash from Curiosity, your eyes will melt and run down your cheeks. Oh my God, they said. And then they started to say nuclear war is bad for our health. And then the business people said nuclear war is bad for business.
We are nearing a stage where some form of civil disobedience a la the 1960s may become essential as we realize that we're all being victimized here now.
And killing leads to 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 killing.
The economic system is indeed precarious, and that's where the drug factor, the drug money factor, in, is that this drug money, this liquid capital, can be highly leveraged to keep our stock markets propped up, and that's why the Taliban destroyed all of their opium in January of this year, and we just conveniently succeeded in conquering Afghanistan in time to plant the next opium crop because the planting season is in November. My words, there will be a flood of heroin on streets all over the world, but particularly, I'm sure, in Europe and North America by this summer.
So it was Bin Laden, Osama Bin Laden, who apparently said that there would be attacks upon Israel and the United States. What do you do? Go and bomb Afghanistan?
On that button, ghetto, we don't wanna know. It's the ultimate reality show. Defense of our glorious homeland. We'll draw a line of blood in the sand. But the only news that will reach us, stock footage and press releases. Nobody will own the pieces. No children own the pieces. We filter our perception of reality through our dependency on primetime TV. Blood for oil, bodies for oil, power and oil. Blood for oil, 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 blood for oil.
I sent American troops to Iraq to stay as an occupying power. I sent American troops a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose lawless tyranny and fanaticism country by country across the greater Middle East. I sent American troops to Iraq to seek the total control of every person and mind and soul. A harsh society in which women are voiceless and brutalized. They seek bases of operation to train more killers and export more violence. And thanks to brave U.S. and coalition forces, they commit dramatic acts of murder to shock, frighten, and demoralize civilized nations. Our actions, too, are guided by a vision. It is a totalitarian political ideology pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience. But this is the world as we find it. We must keep our focus. We must do our duty. History is moving, and it will tend toward tragedy. The failure of freedom would only mark the beginning of peril and violence. But my fellow Americans, we would rather see many Iraqis die than have any live in freedom. We will persevere and hold this hard-won ground for the realm of tyranny.
I hope they realize it's their last goddamn chance.
Kill him!
Kill! Kill! Kill!
Heart of the pitbull! Heart of the pitbull!
Holy Baba!
Kill! Kill! Kill!
You will not kill!
Bring him on. And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Conspiracy theories abound.
You've been listening to Indie Media Radio on Resonance 104.5.